We're going to start with a profound thought. You cannot tailor make the situations in life, but you can tailor make the attitude to fit those situations in life. And because your attitude is so important, and because it affects so many other people, and because it is catching, we want to always remember that as we explore our attitudes, we ask ourselves the question, is my attitude worth catching? Or if anybody does catch it, will they be worse off as a result of it? I believe this story says a whole lot about what I want to say. Mr. B called a meeting. Had all of his people together. He said, you know, we've got a wonderful company here. We're growing, we're expanding, and things are going well. But he said, I noticed that some of us are getting a little slack. Some come in a little late. Some leave a little early. Some spend too much time on coffee breaks. Some spend too much time on lunch breaks. Now, I recognize that a lot of that is my fault. I have not set the kind of an example that I should have been setting. So in the future, you can absolutely count on this. I'm going to come in a little early. I'm going to stay a little late. I'm going to restrict all personal phone calls, none of them. I'm not going to do anything while I'm on the job but be on the job. I will take shorter coffee breaks, shorter lunch breaks. Oh, he really made the commitment. It was quite a little speech, and he was very serious about it. But you know, sometimes in the excitement of the moment, we make those speeches, and then over a period of time, we kind of forget them, and that's what happened. About 3 weeks later, Mr. B was at a luncheon in the country club. Became engrossed in a business conversation, forgot about the time. And all of a sudden, he looked at his watch. He said, oh, my goodness, I'm due back at the office in 10 minutes. He hopped up, made a mad dash to the parking lot, hopped in his automobile, scratched off, burning rubber, doing about 90 miles an hour down the freeway, and the long arm of the law entered the picture. Gave him a ticket. Mr. B was absolutely furious. He said, this is ridiculous. Here I am, a peaceful, tax-paying, law-abiding citizen, minding my own business. Oh, I was going a little fast. I'll admit that. But what these guys ought to be doing is out looking for the robbers, the murderers, the rapists, and those people who are really bad guys. Leave us peaceful citizens alone. Oh, he was really upset. By the time he got to the office, he was quite late, and he did what management has done in some cases since the beginning of time. When they get their hand caught in the cookie jar, they say, look yonder, instead of look here. And so in a loud voice, he called for his sales manager, and everybody could hear him as he said, what I want to know is, did you close the deal on the Armstrong account? Sales manager kind of ducked his head. He said, Mr. B, I don't know what happened on that deal. He said, I thought I had it. I thought it was all wrapped up, signed, sealed, and delivered. But at the last moment, something happened, and it came unglued. Well, if you think Mr. B was upset before, you should have seen him now. He was absolutely furious. He said, this is ridiculous. You know, you've been my sales manager here for 15 years, and I've depended on you to bring in business. And now we have a chance to get the biggest account of them all, and what do? You blow it. Well, let me tell you something, friend. Just because you've been here 15 years does not mean that you've got a lifetime contract. I want that business replaced. We needed that to do the expansion that we needed to do, and here you've lost the biggest opportunity we've ever had. You replace that business, or I'm going to replace you. Oh, he was upset. But if you think he is upset, you should have seen the sales manager. He goes storming out of his office. He slammed the door behind him, muttering under his breath, this is ridiculous. For 15 years, I'm the one who brought in all the business. If it hadn't been for me, this company would have gone down the tube years and years ago. And now just because I missed one lousy sale, he uses a cheap trick. He threatens to fire me. This is not fair. Oh, he was upset. He called his secretary and he said, you know those five letters I gave you this morning? Have you gotten them out? Have you been fooling around doing something else, making excuses about not getting your job done? She said, no. Now, don't you remember? You said to me that the Hilliard account took precedence over everything else, and that's what I've been working on. He said, don't give me any more lousy excuses. I told you I wanted those letters out, and I'm going to tell you right now, if you can't get them out, I'll get somebody who can. Just because you've been here 7 years does not mean that you've got a lifetime contract. Oh, he was really upset. But if you think he is upset, you should have seen that secretary. She goes storming out of his office and said, this is ridiculous. For 7 years, I've been running this company. As a matter of fact, if it weren't for me, they'd have gone down the tube years and years ago. And now just because I can't do two things at once, he uses a cheap, lousy trick threatening to fire me. And him fire me as much as I know about him. Who is he kidding? Oh, she was really upset. She went out to the switchboard operator's desk. She said, I got these five letters. I want to get them out. Now, I know ordinarily this is not your job, but you don't do anything anyhow but sit out here and occasionally answer the telephone. I want these letters out, and if you don't get them out, I'll get somebody who can. Oh, she was upset. But if you think she was upset, You should have seen that switchboard operator. She said, this is ridiculous. They don't do anything in the back but gossip, drink coffee, talk on the telephone. Every once in a while, they get a little bit of work out. And the minute they get behind, they come out here and they put it on my desk and say, now, you've got to get this out. And I'm the only one that does anything around here. Hadn't been for me, the company that had gone out of business years and years ago. Oh, she was really upset. But she got the letters out. She got home. She was still furious. She walked in the front door. First thing she saw was her son laying there on the floor watching television. The second thing she saw was a big old rip right across the seat of his britches. And she said, son, how many times have I got to tell you, when you come home from school, put your play clothes on. Mother has a hard enough time as it is working and sending you through school. Now, because you've been disobedient, upstairs right now, going to be no supper for you tonight and no television for the next 3 weeks. Oh, she was really upset. But if you think she is upset, you should have seen that little boy. He hopped up, running out of the room and said, this is ridiculous. I was doing something for my own mother. She doesn't even give me a chance to explain. It's not fair. He was upset. And about that time, his tomcat walked right in front of him, which was a mistake. Boy reached down and gives the tomcat a big old boot. And he said, now you get out of here. You've probably been up to some no good yourself. Now, here's my question. Wouldn't it have been much better if Mr. B had just gone directly from the country club to that switchboard operator's house and kicked that cat himself and left all of those other people out of it? You see, ladies and gentlemen, I've got a very important question. Whether you're here in this live audience or listening to this recording, here's the question. Whose cat have you been kicking lately? Or have you been letting somebody else kick your cat? You see, the truth is we live in a negative cat-kicking world. I mean, it is all around us. Let me ask you a question. Have you ever been in a coffee shop or restaurant? All you want is a cup of coffee. You walk in, you sit down, and you sit there. And you sit there, and you sit there. And finally, a waiter or waitress comes by, you know, and you timidly hold up your hand and say, ma'am, can I have a cup of coffee, please? Can't you see that I'm busy? I'll get to you as quick as I can. I can't be in three places at once. I mean, at that point, do you look back there and say, well, you don't have to bite my head off about it, do you? Do you respond, which is positive, or do you react, which is negative? See, you get sick, go to the doctor, gives you a prescription, says, see me tomorrow. Now, if when you walk in the next day, he shakes his head and says, uh-oh, your body is reacting to the medicine, you get uptight. But if he or she smiles and says, oh boy, it's working, your body is responding to treatment, then you get all excited. Respond is positive, react is negative. Do you react to the negative situations like the waiter or waitress, or do you understand that it has nothing whatever to do with you? See, somebody had been kicking her cat long before you got there. Nothing to do with you. Were you ever in a traffic situation, traffic about 2 miles in front of you, about 2 miles behind you, and some idiot behind you sits on his horn? Do you turn around and say, can't you see we got traffic up there? Why don't you? I mean, do you get all upset about it? Or do you understand, got nothing to do with you? Somebody's been kicking his cat all day long. I want you to think about this. Whether you respond to life or react to life determines how far you're going to go in life. See, the bum in the Bowery and the mother of the year have got lots in common. The most successful person you know and the most unsuccessful person you know have got lots in common. You see, everybody on the face of this earth have had setbacks, despondent moments, defeats, and disappointments. But the successful people are those people who respond to the setbacks and the disappointments and the negative people in life. How do you respond when you're passed over for a promotion? How do you respond when you expect that shipment to get out on time, meaning an extra bonus for you, and it does not? You see, the way we respond is going to make a tremendous difference, and that's what this segment really is all about. How do we learn to respond instead of reacting to the negative situations of life? Now, in order to do that, we've got to take a layman's look at the way the mind works. Because somebody said, and I believe they're right, If you know how to do something and do it, you'll always have a job. But if you know how to do it and why it should be done this way, you'll be the one who'll be in charge. So let's look from a layman's perspective at the way the mind works. First of all, the mind works somewhat like a garden. You know, we know that if we plant beans, we're going to raise beans. If we plant potatoes, we're going to raise potatoes. In the mind, if we plant a positive, we will raise a positive. If we plant a negative, we will raise a negative. In the garden, though, we don't plant a bean to raise a bean. When we plant a bean, we expect to get a lot of beans from it, do we not? Well, you see, the mind is that way because we have a magnificent imagination. As a matter of fact, somebody said America's not the strongest nation on earth. Russia's not the strongest nation on earth. It's imagination which is the strongest nation on earth. And so when we plant a thought, our imagination takes it, begins to work on it, expands it a great deal. That's why sometimes one positive thought can bring magnificent results and one negative implant can bring incredibly negative results. We need to understand that. Now the mind also, in layman's language, works like the computer. You know, in the computer, we've learned that if you want to change the output, you got to change the input. When you put the good stuff in, you get the good stuff out. The Bible says, as you sow, so also shall you reap. But the mind also works like a bank, and this one, in many ways, somewhat intrigues me. Now, you know, in the bank, as a general rule, you are the only one that makes deposits in your account. At least that's always the way it's been worked at my account. So far, I've never caught anybody making a deposit in my bank account. I'm also the only one, fortunately, who makes those withdrawals from that bank account. Now, in the mind, however, anybody or anything can make deposits in your mind. And so in that respect, it's completely unlike the deposits made at the bank because generally you're the only ones that make those deposits. But an overheard conversation, flip on the radio or television, listen to some kind of recording, and you see somebody else is making deposits in your bank. Now, if they're good deposits, that's wonderful. If they're not good deposits, that's not so good. Now, in your mind bank, you have two tellers. You've got a positive teller and a negative teller, and they're both very obedient. They will do exactly what you tell them to do. Now, when an opportunity, some folks call them problems, those negative ones, when an opportunity arises, you're going to go either to the negative teller to make a withdrawal to solve it, or you're going to go to a positive teller to make a withdrawal to solve it. If you go to the negative teller, you know what the negative teller is going to say? Well, now look, you remember the same situation arose less than 3 weeks ago and you blew it. I've never seen anybody make such an idiot out of themselves as you did. I mean, you just flat dropped the ball in every way. Or you go to the positive teller, and the positive teller will say, hey, this would be a piece of cake for you. Listen, do you remember last August when the same thing came up, and you handled it like a champ? And then later in October, it came up again, and you went through it. I mean, you handled it magnificently well. Now, if we've been making the deposits in the mind and hands of the positive teller, then we go to the positive teller for our withdrawals. But if our deposits have been negative deposits to the negative teller, then that's the one we're going to approach. Now, here's some good news. Until very recently, I'd always been under the impression that it was simply the weight of numbers. That if you had 1,000 positive deposits and 1,001 negative deposits, that you'd go to the one where the most numbers were. But now we have come to know that it is not just the weight of numbers, but rather the impact of the deposit. In other words, if somebody softly and casually says something that you might or might not have complete faith in, it would have minimal impact. But on the other hand, if somebody in whom you have confidence tells you with a tremendous amount of conviction and excitement and enthusiasm that this is the way it is, then you can change more quickly from the negative to the positive. I mention that because, you see, over a period of a lifetime, there might have been an awful lot of people and a lot of events and circumstances which have had an awful lot of negative deposits in your mind. And I want to tell you today that when you start vigorously, excitedly, and enthusiastically making those positive deposits, you can reasonably soon overcome those negatives. But those deposits make a difference. I love the story of the old Eskimo. Up in Alaska, they had dog fights in this little village. And the Eskimo had two dogs. One was a black dog, one was a white dog. And every Saturday, he would take them into this little village, and they would have dog fights. And his two dogs always fought. This went on for several years until finally they retired the two dogs. They just got to put on a good show. Well, one of the people after that asked the old Eskimo, you know, I noticed that when you brought your dogs in, one week the black dog would win and one week the white dog would win. But I noticed that invariably you always managed to bet on the winning dog. Now, here's my question. How did you always know which dog to bet on? With a sly grin, the old Eskimo said, well, I always bet on the dog I'd been feeding all week. Now, let me tell you the teller that I'm going to bet on. I'm going to bet on the one you've been feeding all week. It's a matter of choice, you see, as to what happens there. We go through life making choices. You can choose to be happy, or you can choose to be sad. You can choose to be enthusiastic, or you can choose not to be. They tell me that we can even choose to be insane. In some cases, there are some people, in order to escape the responsibilities of life, will actually take that route. Every choice, however, has an end result. Again, I want to have you so conscious of what's going into your mind that you will ask yourself the question when you pick up a book or look at a magazine or turn on the television set or go to the movie or look at a VCR, you'll ask yourself the question, am I making a positive deposit in my future, or will this deposit actually have a tendency to hamper and hinder my progress in life? Interesting fact, if I were to come into your home with a pail of garbage and dump it on your living room floor, the odds are enormous that one of three things would happen. You would either whip me physically or call the law and have me arrested or get your gun and say, now, Ziegler, I'll just bet you can clean that mess up. And I'll bet I could clean it up, too. But for the next several weeks, maybe months, you'd still be talking about that crazy guy that came in and dumped garbage on my living room floor. I ought to have shot the guy. That's what I ought to have. Wish I had, as a matter of fact. I mean, it is a big deal. I dumped garbage on your living room floor. And yet, for whatever reason, though the damage is infinitely greater and far longer lasting, because, you see, it is a fact that everything you've ever seen or heard or smelled or tasted, or touched, or even thought about, has become a part of you forever. Now, yes, it's true that we can bury it. Now, I want to emphasize that. Again, to quote Dr. Tony Campola, regardless of what our past has been, and regardless of the fact that our past has influenced what we are today, our past is not nearly as important as the way we see the future. And again, Dr. Maxwell says, if there's faith in the future, there is power in the present. But I just want you to understand that those deposits really do make a difference, whatever the deposits are. Now, that includes self-talk. See, 77% of our self-talk is negative. Now, interestingly enough, 77% of all illnesses are psychosomatic. Intriguing, is it, when you begin to explore it? I think of Teresa Jones from Wilmington, Delaware. She was diagnosed as having a very serious kidney problem. A number of tests revealed that she was going to have that kidney removed. And she went in the hospital and she was in the operating room and they were preparing her for surgery. And then they ran that last test to determine, really, is this exactly what we need to do? And the last test revealed that she really did not have the problem they had thought she had had. And so they did not perform the surgery, though she was already out and prepared for the surgery. When she awakened some while later, the first thing she said when she awoke, oh, my back. You see, in her mind, when she was put to sleep, she was going to wake up hurting. And that input, that self-inducement, was absolutely there, the common cold. They now know that if when you first feel the symptoms coming on, that if you will go to the doctor and get some medicine for it, that you will be able to eliminate the cold in an average of 1 week. But if you don't do something about it, you're going to have that sucker for 7 days. Interesting fact. There seems to be virtually nothing that can be done about it unless, of course, you catch it before it really gets a foothold and load yourself up on vitamin C. And that seems to be doing some things with it. But did you know that you are 11 times as likely to catch the cold when you are emotionally down as you are at any other time? Stinking thinking really cost us in a lot of ways, doesn't it? As we'll say a number of times, ultimately it leads to hardening of the attitudes, which is by far the most deadly disease on the face of this earth. Input in our mind, whether our own thinking or what somebody else dumps in, does have an impact. I love the story that Wendell Johnson tells in his book, People in Quandaries. He tells about this missionary who was working with Indians on reservations. And he just happened to notice that the Indians there, not a single full-blooded Indian on reservation, stuttered. And so he became a little curious about this, and he let that word out. And then a scientific study was done of all of the Indians in America on reservations. And they discovered that not a single Indian on a reservation stuttered. Then they studied all of the Indian languages and dialects, and they found out why Indians don't stutter. You see, in the Indian languages and dialects, there is not a single word for stutter. And if there's no word for stutter, how are you going to stutter? Because you see, as we pointed out earlier, words paint pictures in the mind, and then the mind goes to work to complete the picture. Interesting phenomena when you begin to analyze that. You tell somebody it is impossible, you cannot do it, the tendency is not to give it the effort. But if you tell them it's going to be difficult, but you can do it. I think of dyslexia, for example. Now, you see, that is a learning involvement there that makes it far more difficult for them to read than it does you and I. But we know so many hundreds of stories of people who had that, quote, opportunity and overcame it with flying colors. It was tremendously difficult. But a lot of people accept challenge. But when you tell somebody it is impossible, it cannot be done, you see, that's what discourages people. Hope is the ingredient that we want to inject. We also like to always stress the fact that it is not easy. Life is tough, but when you're tough on yourself, then life is going to be infinitely easy on you. In America today, we have over 40,000 schools teaching you how to do different things. You can learn how to trim toenails or take out tonsils. You can learn how to run a computer or drive a 40-ton rig. You can learn how to curl hair, or you can learn how to massage bodies. There are over 40,000 jobs in this country. Over 40,000 schools teaching these various professions, but there's not a single one who will teach anybody how to be any better than mediocre unless they've got the right mental attitude. extensive studies done at Harvard University, Stanford University, and Stanford University, and other independent studies have revealed that 85% of the reason that people get ahead in those jobs is because of the fact that they have right mental attitude. The Cox Report, released in U.S. News and World Report, I believe it was in 1985, revealed a study of over 11,000 successful executives. 49% of those executives said their attitude played an extremely significant role in their success. 46% said attitude played a significant role in their success. At our educational structure today, over 95% of our time and dollars are spent teaching facts, figures, and formulas, and only 5% is devoted to developing the right attitude. And tragically, most of that 5% is built around the athlete. The athletic event itself, the bands, the cheerleaders, the parades, the assemblies, the bonfires, all of that is centered around that. And the average student, therefore, really does not have the opportunity. Now, the exceptions are that many, many educators, many of the teachers, weave in the information in their regular classes. As you know, in our company, we have over 7,000 schools which are teaching our ICANN course, which teaches exactly the same principles that we are learning right here. Your attitude makes a big difference. It's the little bitty things, though, that make the big difference. You know, fellas, you call a girl a kitten and she'll just love you. Call her a cat. You got an entirely different situation. Say she's a vision, you score all kinds of points. Call her a sight, you're in trouble. It is one thing to tell a young lady that she looks like the first day of spring. It is something altogether different to tell her that she looks like the last day of a long, hard winter. I mean, it's the little things that make the big difference. Many years ago, I heard a formula, which I happen to believe is correct. And the formula simply is ability times effort equal results. I believe that's a valid formula. Now, you might be listening to this in your car as you ride down the highway. Or those of you in this live audience might be thinking to yourself, there they go again. They're always trying to get me to work harder. As you will hear me say later on, chances are pretty good that I'll try to get you to work easier or fewer hours. I definitely believe that you've got to have it organized. Now, what we're going to show you to do is through your goals to identify what really is important. Let me tell you what we did in our own company. At our last executive retreat, we have one each year, where the officers in our company and department heads, along with their mates, go off for about 4 days of serious talk, and we also have a couple afternoons of fun and fellowship together. Each evening, we discuss something of significance, something that really is important to all of us. The major topic of discussion introduced the first night at dinner, we have a 3-hour dinner, and continued every night while we were there, was incredibly enough how we can get our top people in our company to work fewer hours. Now, it's not that we're benevolent. Believe me, we are an organization that must make a profit. Our first responsibility is to make a profit. Because if we don't make a profit, then our 80-plus people, including myself, would soon be unemployed. And I would not approve of such an arrangement at all. Then why do I make such a to-do about that? I make such a to-do of it because balance is the key. And if you don't look after the family and don't look after your health and don't look after the other things, you might get more production this year, but in 3 years, something is going to happen and it ain't going to be good. We're looking at the long haul. There's a lot of confusion, an enormous amount, as a matter of fact, about what motivation and positive thinking really is all about. Several years ago, I was on 60 Minutes, and it was a very unusual experience. The correspondent was so skeptical he'd demand a bacteria count on the milk of human kindness. That old boy honestly thinks somebody pushed Humpty Dumpty. I mean, you have seen the kind. Little town he was raised in wanted to start a pessimist club, but nobody thought it'd work. They voted on a procrastinators club, but it's 44-0 to wait. Well, anyhow, first cracker out of the barrel, the first words he said to me after the mic and cameras were turned on were these. Mr. Ziegler, you're one of these positive thinkers. Go all over the country talking about positive thinking, making money, going to the top. He said, you're so positive, he said, you think you could whip Muhammad Ali? Well, that's dumb, even though I fought in the ring 2 years. Instead of the worst I ever finished was second. As a matter of fact, the only reason I quit was because of my hands. The referee kept stepping on them, you know. No, I don't think I could whip Muhammad Ali. I don't even think I could take your appendix out, sir, and have you live. But I tell you what, I'll bet you. I'll bet if you and I were on a desert island all by ourselves, 1,000 miles from everybody else, and all of a sudden you said, oh, my side hurts. And I'd say, let me see. I put my hand on your side. It's burning up with fever. I'd say, man, you got appendicitis, but that's no big deal. I've been watching a lot of television recently, seen no less than a dozen doctor shows in the last month alone, and they were specializing in appendectomies, and I watched them real good. It's not a complicated operation. And I got a good sharp knife with me. I got some good powerful germ-killing medicine. And you know me, I'm so optimistic, I'd go after Moby Dick in a rowboat and take the tartar sauce with me. I believe. Man, I believe we're going to get him out of there. I believe you're going to make it. Now, I believe you would prefer that I take that approach instead of me looking at you and saying, man, you're going to die. Now, there isn't a doctor alive who would not agree with this next statement. The first approach would give you a better chance of survival than the second approach would. But folks, stay with me, because I think this is one of the most significant points that I will make throughout the entire series. I really do. I get awfully nervous and uptight when I hear any speaker stand in front of an audience and say, with positive thinking, you can just do anything. They have not thought it through. Positive thinking won't let you do anything. No way. I think of Wilt Chamberlain. I don't know how many of you are basketball fans, but Wilt Chamberlain was the first legitimate 7-foot basketball player in the National Basketball Association. Scored over 20,000 points, scored 100 points in one game. Of all of the people on this earth who you would have to identify as being a positive thinker, you would have to agree that Wilt Chamberlain was a positive thinker. And yet I'm absolutely convinced, there's no doubt in my mind about it, that Wilt Chamberlain would have been a total and complete failure as a jockey. See, there are limits to what we can do. I don't care how positive I got. I could not perform major surgery on you and have you live. I don't care how positive I got. I couldn't whip a boxing champion or play basketball in the NBA or football in the NFL. I don't care how positive I got. I could not give you a lecture on nuclear physics. There are many things that I cannot do. I don't care how positive I got. Positive thinking won't let you do anything. But it will let you do everything better than negative thinking will. Let me ask the live audience, can you emotionally and intellectually buy that idea? That makes sense, doesn't it? That makes sense. You see, unrealistic expectations are the seedbed of depression and frustration and disappointment. And when you tell somebody that with positive thinking, you can just do anything, and then they think real positive and it doesn't happen, then you see they've got some serious problems. Positive thinking will do this also. It will let you use the ability which you have. I'll give you some examples. Out of our students in our classes, in ICANN courses all over the country. We did one survey of over 1,500 students. 46% of those kids made better grades in their other subjects. Drug usage came down. Violence and vandalism came down substantially. Self-image is improved. Attitudes improved. But 46% of them made better grades in their other subjects. Right down here in Mule Shoe, Texas, the first year the course was taught, Jerry Johnson was the teacher. 44 kids were in the class. They were juniors and seniors. 19 of the 44, that's 43%, made the honor roll for the first time in their lives. Convince them they can learn, they can be successful. They're not going to quit. It really, in most cases, is almost that simple. The child or the student who does not think he can learn, who does not think he can pass, won't study. Now, you change that attitude, convince them they can learn, they will open their books and study. It is the attitude that made the difference. I still haven't said it's easy. You will hear me repeat it many times. Life is not easy. Life's tough. But when you're tough on yourself, then life is going to be infinitely easier on you. It's just an absolute fact of life that negative people seldom persist. They throw in the towel at the first sign of difficulty. Always. What this will do is let you use the ability you have. Let me share this with you to maybe explain how it relates to grades. I want to tell you your story, and you'll recognize it immediately. When you were in school, you took a test. You walked out of the test, and one of your buddies said, "How'd you do?" You said, "Daggone it all, I can't believe it. I studied that formula. I had it down letter perfect. Went over it five times last night. And then I got in there and I did what I always do. I forgot it. I can't believe I did." Am I talking to you? Now, let me tell you why you forgot it. You forgot it because you instructed yourself to forget it. Very simple. That is the reason you forgot it. Now, in ICANN and in this series, we simply teach you to change the input. Now, I want to emphasize something. If that young'un, if that student, if that child has not studied their lessons, all the positive thinking in the world is not going to produce the right answer on the test. But if they have studied and stored the information, positive thinking, an optimistic outlook, will release that information and they'll be able to communicate it either verbally or write it out on the test question. Does that make any sense to you? So you got to have the information in there. It works something like this. When we walked in here this morning, this room was dark. They started flipping switches, and then it was light. Now, flipping the switches did not generate any electricity. What flipping the switches did was release the electricity, which was stored and ready to use. Now, had that electricity not been stored earlier, we could still be flipping switches, and we still would not be in a lighted room. And I don't care how many positive thinking switches the student switches, if they haven't stored the information by studying, which requires work, then they still would not have the answers. What I'm saying is that if you want to run the marathon, you got to get in shape to run the marathon. You can't one day think positive and say, "Well, I'm going to go run the marathon." It just doesn't work that way. If you want to be a physician, you got to study and acquire and store that information. Positive thinking is not going to make you a physician. Motivation. What is it really all about? I get a lot of questions from the media concerning this particular thing. Their favorite question is, "Now, Zig, I know you're going to be talking to these people here this morning. I believe it'll be 3 hours." "Yeah. Are you going to get them excited?" "Well, shucks, I hope so, but most of them are already excited. That's the reason they're here." "All right, Zig, ask me this question now. After you get these people all excited and so forth, where will they be a month from now, 6 months from now, a year from now?" What they're really asking me is, "Ziglar, is motivation permanent?" The answer is no, motivation is not permanent. But then neither is bathing. But does that mean I am opposed to bathing? Not at all. As a matter of fact, I think so highly of it, I think you ought to do it every day. I mean, every day we ought to do our bathing, especially if we're using that new 23-hour deodorant. The company that makes it figures everybody's entitled to some time on their own. Is motivation permanent? The answer is no. Let me share with you how ridiculous some people are on this particular subject. I spoke in Washington for the National Council of Parents for Drug-Free Youth. Wonderful organization. Mrs. Reagan was there. Brooke Shields was there. She had done a commercial for them. I was the wind-up speaker that evening. Marvelously responsive audience. They laughed at all of my jokes, which incidentally is a sign of intelligence. They said good things about me. I woke up higher than a kite next morning. I mean, I was still all excited about the evening before. Went down to the restaurant to get my breakfast. And I was standing there awaiting my turn to be seated. There were about a dozen people behind me. The host had gone out to seat the couple in front of me. Now, I don't know how you stand when you stand, but when I stand, I just stand. For example, I don't know how to stand motivated, so I was just standing there. And these three ladies walked in, and they had been there the evening before. And as they approached, they spotted me, and whispering in tones that you could only hear about 150 yards, one of them said, "There's our speaker from the night before." Second one said, "Yes, and he is obviously a night person." Third one said, "He must be." He said, "He sure don't look motivated to me." Well, now, like I say, I don't know how you stand when you stand. But when I stand, I just stand. I don't know whether the ladies expected me to be standing there grinning out at everybody in the audience, you know, waving my hand at them and jumping up and down at the same time. That's motivation. That's insanity. So many people think that the motivated, enthusiastic individual is wild and crazy. And that simply is not so. Enthusiasm itself comes from two Greek words, in theos, and it literally means God in us. Some of the most motivated, enthusiastic, excited people I have ever met in my life are basically very quiet. President of our company is a classic example, Ron Isinger. Ron is not a hand-clapping, whooping, shouting, hollering kind of a fella. But I'll guarantee you, you get around him for 3 minutes and you can sense the intense excitement which is there. Jim Savage is exactly the same way. And we can number them all over the place. I can give you hundreds of examples of that. Motivation is not being wild and jumping up and down and whooping and shouting. Now, why do we need motivation? Why is something like this so important? Why do we need it on a daily basis? We need it on a daily basis because demotivation is all around us. The reality is we live in a negative world. Dr. J. Allen Peterson, in his beautiful book, The Myth of the Greener Grass, reports on a computer study which says that over 90% of the input in our minds on a daily basis is of a negative nature. We see so much of it. Our terminology, our expressions, our phrases too many times are negative. Our self-talk. Overweight person sits down at the table and says, "Everything I eat turns to fat." Negative. Parrot sends a child off to school. Now, don't you get run over. Negative. They bring out a loaf of bread. What do they call the first slice on the loaf of bread? First slice. The heel or the end? Isn't that insane? You know, I never saw a loaf of bread in my life that didn't have two beginnings. Never, not even one. We wake up in the morning with the aid of an electronic rooster. What does the average person call that electronic rooster? Alarm clock. But they sound the alarm when the building catches on fire. That scares people. They sound the alarm when they're robbing a bank. That scares people. If you get up to an alarm, no wonder that scares people and makes them negative. It's an opportunity clock. Well, you think about it. If you can hear it, that gives you an opportunity to get up and go. If you can't hear it, that might mean you done got up and gone. We have two cars run together right out in the front of the building. 3 minutes later, somebody is saying, call the wrecker. And you done had the wreck. What you need is a tow truck. Our terminology is negative. We need to change it to the positive. Does it apply to everybody? I was coming in from out of town not too long ago. Dallas at night with the beautiful lights is magnificent. But as we were coming in, the captain of the aircraft, the head honcho, as we'd say down home, the daddy rabbit himself, got on the intercom and in that deep, resonant voice announced, we are now making our final approach. Scared the wits out of me. I told the stewardess, I said, quick, ma'am, go tell them to make it his next final approach. I still got some things I really want to get done. How many of you folks here ever hit a golf ball? See your hands? Were you ever part of a foursome and some dude steps up to the tee and he dribbles a ball into the lake and he turns to the other three and says, I knew I was going to do that. Then why did he do it? That is not the object of the game. Why did not he back away and say, new program, and then step back up there and bust that dude right down the middle where he wanted it to go? You ever lay down late at night? Got to get up early the next morning? Last thing you do is you look at your watch and say, boy, but I'm going to be tired tomorrow. Isn't it amazing? We ask for what we don't want. Speaking in Sydney, Australia, I met a man named Graham Bura. He's a golf professional. He specializes in teaching blind golfers how to play golf. He said, Zig, now I never tell one of the golfers when they step up to the tee, now be careful, if you hook it, you're going to be out of bounds. And don't dare top it because you'll be in the creek. And if you push it off to the right, you'll be in the swamp. And if you hit it too far, you'll be in the highway. He said, what I always tell them is this. With that beautiful, smooth stroke you've got, and you've got the right club in your hand, you've addressed the ball absolutely perfectly. Just give me that good old smooth stroke, which is yours, and that ball will end up right on the green. I paint a picture in their mind of what they want to have happen. See, really, folks, since the mind goes to work to complete the picture, that's the major purpose of this series, is to help you paint the pictures in your mind of what you want to have happen. Thank you. We'll be right back.